Pleasure, pleasure. Welcome back. Okay, so welcome everyone to a new term. Good to see a lot of people we haven't seen for a while. I said to someone before, now that everyone's had coffee, the pressure's on, I better give a good cheer because everyone's paying attention today. So we've called this topic upgrading your consciousness, updating your consciness. And if you notice the byline, it said upgrading the things, the truths you learned in preschool to a much deeper comprehension, internalization, and application. So let me just spend a few minutes giving the introduction and explaining what I mean by all that and what I plan to do this term during this topic in this series. So it's something actually that I tried in one of the shiurim that we had in people's houses. I think it was Kim's house we did this. The Jewish people are known as the people of the book, right? I hope I remember how to use this. We know that one of the things that's always been a constant in Jewish history is the importance on knowledge, the importance to know, the importance to delve deeply into understanding the Torah, understanding God's wisdom, and understanding things in general. You know, it's interesting that we find ourselves now in the Jewish calendar in the 3 weeks. It's a three-week period where we mourn the destruction of the temple. And one of the amazing things, the historic things, and I think I've mentioned this before, is that after the temple was destroyed, it was thought then that the Jewish infrastructure would just fall apart, and it didn't. And the reason it didn't is because prior to the destruction, some of this, a long story, but just very briefly, prior to the destruction, the sages then of the Sanhedrin ensured that the center of learning should be relocated to a different town. So Jerusalem was destroyed, but the center of learning was relocated to a place called Yavne, and the Romans didn't mind because they thought that's really insignificant and not really relevant until they realized the mistake. And we know that through the ups and the downs of Jewish history, one thing remained constant is the power of knowing. So it really is the secret. Actually, if you really want to know the secret to Jewish survival and Jewish eternity, it's always been the commitment to learning, the commitment to knowledge, the commitment to understanding. Now, there are many, many ideas, right? So I mean, this class on a Thursday morning is a personal growth discussion, always is, and it's going to be this way as well, but I'm going to do it in a sort of interesting way this term, because I think I've told you the story before, but a number of years ago, I was at someone's house. I was doing a lecture sometime before Rosh Hashanah, and I was sitting next to a middle-aged gentleman, and we got talking, and he asked me what I do, and talked about Jewish learning and adult education and so on. And he said to me, no, Jewish knowledge doesn't talk to him. He's now exploring other things. So that's interesting. Jewish knowledge, I think, is pretty exciting. So I said, can I ask you a question? I said, it's Rosh Hashanah next week. He said, yeah. I said, you know, we eat apple and honey in Rosh Hashanah. He said, yeah. I said, you know why? So he said to me, yeah, because apple and honey should be a sweet year. So I said, when did you learn that? He said, I don't know, as far as I can remember. I mean, because that's the truth. Everyone learns this in kindergarten, right? I said, that's it? That's all you know about it? He said, yeah, well, that's the reason, isn't it? I said, no wonder you look to other things. Because if you stay with your... What you learned is a truth, an absolute truth, a foundational truth, that is why we eat apple and honey in Rosh Hashanah, that is true. But you've stayed with your underdeveloped knowledge. You haven't furthered it. Because there's hours and hours of stuff of why we eat apple and honey and the Kabbalistic reasons and the personal growth lessons that we can learn from it and so many different things, right, that we can understand if you develop your learning. We do that in every other area of discipline. We don't learn the same maths in year 10 that we learn in kindergarten. Hopefully, and science and English and everything else. So while we're doing that with Jewish learning, right? And that, I think, is one of the problems we face today, that there's so much depth, infinite depth in so many different ideas, but sometimes for whatever reason, we remain with the truth that we learn, but we remain with the level of sophistication or the level of depth of things we learn when we're very, very young, right? Now, let me just develop that for a moment, because that's what I want to sort of create sort of a formula and a model of how we're going to do this. So we've done this many times in the past, but just to explain that we know that there are three levels of knowing, right? There are three levels of, right? As we know, Chochma, Bina, and Da'at, right? We've talked about this before. So in the soul, we have 10 powers of the soul. The first three are intellectual. What's the difference? I'm going to do this briefly because we've done it many times, but what's the difference between Chochma, Bina, and Da'at? So Chochma and Da'at, we know that Chochma is the conception of an idea, right? It's the truth of the idea. So it's like, for example, you're trying to solve a problem. Or you taught something, but you taught the very basics of it, the truth of it, right? And you get taught the kernel of truth, the foundation of the idea. That's called Chochma. It's very underdeveloped. That's why it's called the conception of an idea, right? Or, for example, if you're trying to solve a problem, you're trying to have a very difficult, complex issue that you want to develop and you want to try and understand, and you think and you think and you think, and suddenly there's a light bulb. Oh, I got it, right? I solved the problem. I've cracked the code. That first flash of intense truth, an intense clarity in a way where you know that's it, I now understand it, that's Chochma. The problem with Chochma is that it's very underdeveloped, right? And from Chochma, in order to know something, you have to go to something we call Bina. Bina, the word Bina means binyan, a building. We have to take that idea and then develop it to give it depth, give it breadth, give it analysis, give it sophistication, right? And delve into it from all different angles and all different deep sort of ways that we can understand it until we build a intellectual edifice. That's the idea of Bina, to build it, right? So that we understand and that people understand that you have to do that, obviously. Because if you don't do that, then the original truth that you have, the original foundation, the original kernel of truth that you engage in will dissipate. It'll disappear, right? But then there's a third way of knowing, and this is a really, really important one. It's something that we often don't do very well. And it's the concept of Da'at. So Da'at means connecting and internalizing, right? What is Da'at and what's its function? So we know that the idea of knowledge is supposed to guide how we feel and how we behave, right? That's the uniqueness of the human being. So the human being are people, human beings are people that can make, that can decide, they can make decisions between right and wrong, moral and immoral, and so on. Why? Because we can think, and we can process information. We can, before we react to stimulus on the outside, as explained in more sort of modern psychology, there's a pause. During that pause, we can think, we can objectively think, we can objectively develop ideas, we can explore ideas, and then based on those ideas, we can make decisions, right? And those ideas then will influence and inspire and educate how we feel emotionally and how we then act. But we also know that very often that doesn't happen, right? As we've explained many times in the past, that there's a big jump between intellect, between the head and the heart, between intellect and emotion. And very, very often people understand things very well, but there's like a cognitive dissonance. So they will feel and act in ways that is completely incompatible and inconsistent with the way they understand, right? So people can develop values, they can develop ideas, they can develop personal growth ideas, they can do everything, and yet don't implement them and don't internalize them. Why? Because it's all in the head, and the head is a detached thing. So yes, I know I shouldn't get angry. I know I shouldn't be jealous, right? Or I know I shouldn't scream at the person who offended me, or whatever the case is, right? But it's not in my heart. I'm not connected to it. It's a foreign idea. It's a disconnected idea, right? So in order to make sure that it's not like that, we have the third stage of knowing called Da'at. Da'at often is translated as knowledge, but it's a mistranslation. Because in the Torah, the word Da'at actually means connection, right? In fact, in Genesis, in Bereshit, where we find often a word referring to intimacy, like it says, Adam was intimate with his wife and they gave birth to children, Abraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, and so on. The term the Torah uses is Da'at. V'adam yada et chava ishto. He knew his wife, so to speak. What does that mean? He was connected to her. He was intimate with her. So in terms of processing information, that means, and this is a very important part, that means connecting to what I understand. To the point where I connect to it and internalize it to such a degree that it starts to become me. I start to feel what I'm thinking. I start to feel what I'm intellectualizing, right? How do you do that? So there's many ways. One of the ways of doing it is revising, reviewing, to learn something again and again and again, often a very difficult thing to do. I know as kids, this was always the one thing our teachers always used to tell us. We used to learn pages of the Talmud, sometimes complex things, and we'd get it and understand it. And then the teacher would always say, there was a term they used to use in yeshiva called chazara, chazara. Chazara means lachzor, to come back to it, to review it, right? Chazara, right? To keep on reviewing it again and again and again. Why? Because even though you've understood it the first time, but you won't retain it. Even intellectually, you won't retain it. Definitely not on an emotional level. So when you learn something once and twice and three times and many, many times, you start to connect to the idea. Another way of doing it is the idea of reflecting and meditating on the idea. There's a Jewish form of meditation which we're going to try a little bit. We're going to have some fun this time. Okay? That's why I gave you coffee in the beginning. So you should be alert and focused and mindful. Yeah, something like that. So there's a form of meditation that is often practiced amongst those who study in-depth Hasidut and Kabbalah and so on, called Hitbonenut. Hitbonenut means where you... distinct from Hitbodedut, I think you're thinking of, but this is Bodedut and Hitbonenut. So Hitbonenut is when you take an idea, right, and you meditate on the idea so that it becomes part of who you are, right? So with that introduction, what I want to do this term is I want to take Jewish ideas, things that I know you know about, and I'm sure you learned about it very, very early on. And number one, upgrade it. Learn its lessons, its deep lessons. Lessons that we can learn in life from these ideas. And then towards the end, so that's the Bina part of it. So the Chochmah, some of these ideas, you have the Chochmah already because you know the truth, you know the foundation. But what we want to do is give it Bina, give it a building, give it depth, give it a little bit more than we're used to knowing. And then maybe spend just a few minutes with the Da'at trying to internalize it. We're okay? We're good? So the topic I want to take today is mezuzah. Right? You all know mezuzah, right? Okay, so let's try this out. Why do we have a mezuzah? Come on, don't be shy.
To take the heart,
right? Yeah?
Coming and going.
What is a mezuzah? Sorry?
Protection.
Right, it's got the Shema, protection. Okay, so mezuzah protection, right? What's in the mezuzah? Just the Shema?
No.
What else? Sorry?
I don't know.
I'm not trying to catch you up.
It's okay.
The ethics of the father says those who are bashful do not learn, right? So it's fine. You know that. It says that. It says whoever's impatient cannot teach, whoever's bashful cannot learn. So that's what works, right? So I'm assuming that the concept of having a mezuzah on the door, that's a protection, is something that you learned a long time ago, correct?
Yes.
So that's the preschool version or the primary school version. Now, it's absolutely true. It's true, it's pure, it's authentic, right? No question. I mean, the Rambam is full of it, the Talmud is full of it, the Kabbalah is full of it, that we mezuzah is a powerful source, it's a powerful thing, it provides protection. But I think we owe it to ourselves to understand much more about mezuzah than just that, and understand what does that protection actually mean? Like, what are we protecting? And what does that protection mean on a deeper level? And why on the door? Why not on the window? I mean, you know, why?
And also, it's got to be on a certain angle.
Yeah, why? Why on an angle?
Inwards, because it's your home where your Judaism is practiced, where your values
are. Okay, but that's one idea. Yeah, not true. Okay, we're pointing on that a little bit.
And it's at an angle, so it's not straight, about compromise.
Okay, but how does it fit into the general concept of mezuzah, right? So let's try and explore that. So what I want to do is I want to go through just some facts and fun facts about mezuzah, so just for interest sake, for Jewish knowledge sake, and then go into a deep idea of tremendous lesson. Because I called today, if you saw it on the On the handout, I've called today creating oneness, and you'll see at the end what the idea, what the connection between that and mezuzah is, right? And there's, like everything in learning, and this is an important idea to understand, every Jewish idea that we learn and we explore happens on multiple levels. Right? That's the way the Torah works. Everything that's, we have what's called the pshat, which is the simple literal meaning. We have the halachic and midrashic meanings, then we have the mystical meanings, right? So I want to try and sort of take you through a few of those layers and then really understand what it's all about. Now, the laws of mezuzah are very, like all mitzvot, are very complex, because mitzvot are like, every mitzvah that we do is not just a symbol. So that's a Jewish concept, right? That mitzvot are not symbols, not cultural symbols. Why is that important? Because if they were cultural symbols, it really would make a difference exactly how you do it and how high is it and how important and how the letter is written. Because mitzvot are not symbols. Mitzvot are connections. Mitzvot. So the best analogy I can always think of it is a mitzvah is like, imagine if you wired your home, right? I'm not going to be very good at this, but because I would never attempt this. But you know, when you wire a home, there's different color wires, I think, and there's green and there's yellow. I don't know, there's red, whatever, right? And they each got to go in a certain place. And it's very minute. So whatever the guy decides is wiring the home, you know, I'll put the red one in the yellow one. What's the difference, right? It won't work. The whole thing will blow, right? Because it's got to be wired correctly. So spiritually, it works like that also. All mitzvot create connections, and that's divinely designed of how the connections work. But they work if you wire them correctly. That's why mezuzah has to be kosher. And to make a mezuzah kosher, for example, takes a lot of effort because it's very intricate, right? But I want to just run through some of the things with you so you understand. First of all, what's the translation of the word mezuzah? What does the word mezuzah actually mean? Anyone know? This might come as a surprise to you. We call it a mezuzah. By the way, when I say mezuzah, I mean the scroll, okay, not the case, right? But what does the word mezuzah mean? So it became traditional to use it. The word mezuzah means a doorpost. It doesn't mean a scroll. A doorpost. And in fact, and I'm going to come back to this at the end, so remember this fact. The first time the word mezuzah is mentioned in the Torah is not with regard to a mezuzah that we put on the door. It's when the Jews left Egypt and they had to slaughter the Paschal lamb and they had to put the blood on the doorpost and on the, what do you call that thing on the top?
Lintel.
Yeah. That it says you should put the blood on the mezuzah. Over there they put it on both mezuzahs, on both doorposts. But yeah, so the word mezuzah actually means doorpost, right? So where do we write the mezuzah? Mezuzah has to be written by hand. It has to be written on parchment. Parchment is taken from an animal. And significant. Remember that fact, because we're going to come back to that at the end as well.
Kosher.
Sorry?
Kosher animal.
Yeah, it's going to be kosher, correct, right? Now, what's interesting is what's written on the outside of the mezuzah. So actually, on the actual scroll is what, right? So it's actually the name of God, Shin Dalid Yud, right? Now, God has seven names, the seven holy names of God. One of them is Shaddai, which is one of the names of God, right? Shin Dalid Yud. But the word Shin Dalid Yud, if you can see on your handout, those who can decipher the Hebrew there, is also an acronym. Like, why do we choose that name of God? It's an acronym for Shomer Daltot Yisrael, the guardian of the doors of Israel. Right? Shomer Daltot Yisrael. Okay? So that's one of the ideas why we use that. Now, the next thing is just a fun fact. It's not going to tie into what I'm going to share with you, but I have to share this with you because it's unbelievable. If you ever saw a mezuzah scroll, you'll see there's something else written. Have a look at your handout. Under the words, just top of the line that says spiritual protection. There's three words there. You see that? Chaf vav zayin vav, bet mem vav samach zayin, chaf vav zayin vav. Right? Those words mean nothing. What are they? It's a code. It's written on the outside of the mezuzah. It's not one of the requirements. If it's not there, the mezuzah is still kosher. But it became a custom very early on. In fact, there was some controversy with regard to this custom because you're not supposed to add things to the mezuzah. But it became accepted because it's the outside of the mezuzah. It's a code for, you know the sentence Shema Yisrael? So it's Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, right? Hashem Elokeinu Hashem. Look at this line. It's the letter right after each of the letters of Hashem Elokeinu Hashem. So Hashem is spelled in the Torah Yud and Hey, Vav and Hey. This is the letter right after. Chaf Vav Zayin Vav. See that? After the Yud is a Chaf, after the Hey is a Vav. The next one is Elokeinu, but just the next letter after each. And the next one is again Hashem. So it's Hashem, Elokeinu, Hashem, but it's in code form. What's very fascinating is that this is like a code for Hashem's name, but it was a code that it was a system of code that became very useful. When the Jews lived in Russia under communism, there was large, very large Hasidic communities there. My ancestors come from Russia. I mean, a lot of, particularly in the Chabad group and in the Stolen group, a few groups have their roots in Russia, unlike other Hasidim where the roots are mostly in Poland, but or Hungary. But when they lived in Russia, so after the Russian Revolution, when communism started and they tried to stamp out religion, for many, many, many years, every piece of mail, every piece of communication was always censored. And they used to look, the guys used to look for any references to their Rebbe or to Yiddishkeit. So sometimes they would communicate in code form. And a lot of the code form, they used to use this code form. There were certain things they would use letters, and the Hasidim knew they just have to go a letter back. Right? So they would use the same code form that's on the other side of a mezuzah. Okay.
So when you say on the outside, what do you mean it's on the outside? On the outside of the parchment?
Yeah. So inside the parchment, you have the two paragraphs.
Yes. Yeah, so it's on
the first two paragraphs of the Shema. Shema, Vayim, Shema. Right? And the simple reason for that is because the Shema is the foundation of Judaism, and all the principles of Judaism and values are in the Shema. So, first of all, the basic commitment to the oneness of God, the belief in God, the faith of God, love of God, and the commitment to mitzvot are all in the first two paragraphs of Shema in summary form, which is why the Shema is such an important, not just the sentence of Shema, but the whole, especially the first two paragraphs, right? That's what's written in the mezuzah. How do we know we have to write it, those two paragraphs? Because those are the two paragraphs that have in it that you have to write the mezuzah. So, So that's the the case. Of course, mezuzot always puts place in a case. You can have as least fancy or as most fancy as you want, but the case actually is very insignificant. In fact, there was a time where people didn't even have cases; they just used to wrap it in paper. But a case is fine, but it's not. It's definitely not the part of the mezuzah. You know that famous story about the guy that renovated his house and repainted his house and. The painter told the guy afterwards, I did you a favor. You know those things you have on the door? I threw out the instructions. Anyway, but... Now, just... I'll put there the cost. People always ask, why does it cost so much money, right? The reason is because it's extremely labor-intensive. Right? A person has to qualify to become a scribe. It has to be handwritten with ink and a quill. And every letter, right? Every letter has multiple laws. It's not the font. If you ever looked in a Sefer Torah and a mezuzah, you'll see it's a special kind of each letter has a certain shape and has lots of halachot. And if it's miswritten, if it's not written properly, or if it's cracked, if it's connected to the other letter, it's all invalid, right? That kind of thing. So that's why. Now, where do we put the mezuzah? We put the mezuzah on the right side. Now, the right side is very complicated sometimes because what do you mean the right side? It depends what side of the door you are, right? So the front door, that's easy. The rest of the door is not so easy. So there's a whole set of halachot, exactly what the right side means. Like, what's considered, which side of the door is considered going in. Right? Depends what's more important, depends what the door is made for. Sometimes, I get confused. Sometimes I have to ask Rabbi Israel to come and, just when I re-put the mezuzah in my house, if I check them once in a while, I bring it to my house just to make sure that we've done it right, because he's the expert. So it's got to be on the right side, and it's got to be hung slanted. Now, right? On a slant. Mostly Ashkenazim do that. Sfaradim don't do that. But it's slanted, right? The reason for that is because there's two opinions. Now, halachic reason, there's two opinions. One opinion is that it should be straight. Another opinion is it should be like this. So we go compromise. We go slanted. Now, that in itself is a very strange thing, by the way. And that's, I'm going to come back to this, just remember this. Because, why is it a strange thing? Because we don't have that system in halacha. We don't. When we have a dispute in the Talmud between two people about should be done this way or that way, I'll give you an example. So Hanukkah, we light candles from 1 to 8, right? But we know that in the Talmud there's a dispute. The school of Shammai said you should light it 8 to 1, right? So we don't compromise. We just have a system of who we go by, right? So why don't we just decide which one we're going to go by, straight or horizontal, right? So leave it to the end. There's a very, very deep lesson there. The blessing, of course. Checking a mezuzah is important. You do once in a while, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
No, it shouldn't be. It needs to be redone then. It should be angled.
It
should be angled going in.
And you say which doors it doesn't go?
Yes, it doesn't go. It goes on all doors, but it doesn't go on a bathroom. Right? Or it doesn't go on a closet. It's got to be a certain... The room has to be a certain size.
Why do you need to keep finding out if it is kosher? Let's just say
So the in Shulchan Aruch it says one should check mezuzahs twice in 7 years. That's the expression. The reason is because they sometimes fade. They sometimes crack. In Sydney, with the moisture and the rain, especially the ones on the outside, needs first to be very well waterproofed. Otherwise, they don't have a long life, unfortunately.
Which is the preeminent place to check your mezuzahs in
Sydney? Binner. At the moment, it's the only place. But no, not because, I wish there were more places, actually, but we're not there. So we actually have a service that we do check mezuzahs, but it is important to check once in a while, especially, I will mention this, and this is a very unfortunate fact, and it's a painful fact. The painful fact is that you've got to be careful where you buy your mezuzah, especially in Israel, unfortunately. Because, and it pains me to say this, but there are many people in Israel, many stores, are very religious-looking people who will take you for a ride. Both mezuzahs and tefillin. Right? I always tell people, don't buy your mezuzah and tefillin in Israel, because you walk into a store, chances are you get the wrong thing. And you can pay a lot of money for it, and it's a painful thing, but there are people, kinds of people.
Buy them here, Rabbi, where are they getting?
No, they do come from Israel, but I know where they're coming from. Of course, okay, yeah. I mean, no, Israel or America or other places, but so most of the ones we have are coming from Israel, but they're coming from a place. They come through Melbourne, but we know who's written them, we know where the sofer is, we know who it is, we know how it's been written, and it's been checked. So a new mezuzah is always checked. In fact, the mezuzahs that we have are always checked twice. So they're checked in Israel by the scribe that wrote them, but they're always rechecked. Because there's a lot of that. Sometimes, human error, right? Sometimes there can be little, I don't know what you call them, schmitzigs, little, we call tagin, little things, little crowns, that maybe the sofer forgot to fill in or whatever, that right? So it's always rechecked again before we get it. But then, yeah.
So, Rabbi, there's a shortage at the moment. What's one supposed to do? On a new house?
You have to just wait and nudge. The shortage of everything in the world, but yeah. No, there's a shortage. It's true. There's a shortage. You know why, by the way? One of the reasons the shortage, well, there's a shortage of everything in the world, but a fascinating thing. You know why there's a shortage? During COVID, I just heard this the other day. During COVID, many scribes stopped writing mezuzahs or writing Torah scrolls. The reason is because in the world, in America, a lot of people made smaller minyanim, right? Home minyans, things like that. And a lot of people who were able to afford it ordered their own Sefer Torah. So the last couple of years, the Sefer Torahs became very popular.
Because people had.
Sorry?
And more lucrative for them.
Probably, and whatever. And yes.
Rabbi, can I ask you one
other question?
Sure. When a Jew moves home, what do you do with that?
Very interesting. So the law is that if you move home and you know that a Jew is moving into your house, you actually have to leave them as a Zazidi. No, then you take them out. Take them down and move them to the new house. Yeah.
And how long after you move should you have the mezuzah?
So within 30 days.
Really?
Yeah.
But now with the delay.
But you've got delay.
But if you can't get it, you can't get it. I mean, but yeah.
But even if you're renting.
Also 30 days. If renting, living in a house means.
No, buy, I mean like between moves.
If you're going to be there for more than 30 days.
Yeah.
If you move in, like you don't have to put a mezuzah when you go to a hotel, right? Yeah, no. If you're going to live somewhere for more than 30 days, you should have a mezuzah. Yeah. Okay.
Is the scribe of the Torah automatically qualified to be a scribe of a mezuzah?
Yeah, scribe is a scribe. Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, I'll tell you another fun fact. Since you asked the question, we better move because I want to get into the deeper lessons. But I'll tell you a fun fact. When scribes train, first of all, there are two different types of scribes. There are scribes that just check and there are scribes that write. Like Rabbi Israel, he doesn't write. He checks. Right? He can write, but that's not his thing. He checks, right? But scribes who write, normally the first thing they write is a Megillah on Purim. Why? Because a Megillah doesn't have Hashem's name. In the whole Megillah, we've talked about this before. The Megillah story doesn't have Hashem's name, right? So therefore, it's easy to practice on, it's easy to make mistakes. Because if you make a mistake, then you can rub it out. If you start writing a mezuzah right away, you become a scribe, and then you write Hashem's name, and you make a mistake, you can't rub God's name out. And also, mezuzah has to be written exactly in order, so it's more complicated. So normally, it's very common for scribes when they train to write a Megillah first. Right? And that's... I have a nephew that became... Like, he's learning to scribe. He wrote a Megillah. That's what he's done. He hasn't written any mezuzahs yet. He just wrote a Megillah. He just finished the Megillah, and now he's going to go on to other things, I suppose. All right. Now, we know that a mezuzah provides protection. I should point out that essentially, we put a mezuzah on the door. That's not why we put a mezuzah on the door. Okay, that's an important thing to understand, because very, very often mitzvot bring a certain energy, they bring a certain benefit, a certain reward, or whatever it might bring. But that's not the reason that we do. We do it because God said so. Right? So God said we should put a mezuzah on the door, so that's why we do it. But intrinsic to the mitzvah mezuzah is the concept of protection, right? And a very beautiful symbol behind the protection. I'll just share with you a story before we go into the deep idea. There's there was a very famous Talmudic sage called Unkelus. Unkelus was a convert, and he wrote the famous Targum Unkelus, the Aramaic translation of the Chumash, which is printed in most Chumashim. He was a member of the Roman royal family. His uncle was one of the emperors, something called Hadrian, right? And this Unkelus was very dissatisfied with his life. He was looking for meaning. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he wound up with the Jews and he converted. And then his uncle heard about it and was furious. He went to Jerusalem and he became one of the greatest sages. He was a very, very great sage. So his uncle sent a group of soldiers to go and get him back, kind of thing. So they came, they engaged him in a conversation, he switched them around, he persuaded them, and they became Jewish. So that didn't work. Second one, sort of a similar thing happened. Eventually, Hadrian sent a whole group of guys, and he says, listen here, this is the instructions. You come, you take Unkelus, and you don't have any conversation, nothing. There's no, don't talk to him, right? So they arrived. They started to carry the orders. They, I don't know, handcuffed him or whatever. Oh, not handcuffed him, because we'll see the story. But they took him and they said, you're coming with us. He was smiling. He was very happy. And on the way out, he put his hand up to the mezuzah to kiss it. So the curiosity got the better of them. And I said, first of all, why are you so happy? Second of all, what was that all about? So he said, like they said, I laugh at foolish people. That's why I'm happy. He says, a king sits in his palace and guards around him protect him from danger. But the Jewish king, the Lord of the world, allows his servants to sit quietly at home and he protects them from the outside. So they got into a conversation and they stayed also. Eventually, a whole story happened that he sent him a message that he promises him, he wants him to come visit him, and he promised him he won't harm him. And he went and explained to him and he sent him back and it was all good. So that in itself is an amazing thing, right? The protection part of the mezuzah is not just God protects us, that's an amazing thing. And normally, the servant has to protect the king. Here, the king protects the servant. In other words, it's God who puts us in this world. He gives us meaning. He gives us a purpose. And he supports us in that journey, right? I'll tell you a very quick story. I remember as a child, there's hundreds of stories like this. But so very, very often when people would have any issue and they would write to the Lubavitcher Rebbe for advice, often the Lubavitcher Rebbe would tell them to check the mezuzahs. It was a story, a very interesting story. I remember as a kid in South Africa, I remember the family very well. There was a family who had a child in kindergarten. And you know, nowadays schools are maybe proper security and everything, but it wasn't like that those days. And this kid, for some reason, kept leaving the gate of the kindergarten, which was very unsafe, right? And I don't know what to do. It was like a crazy thing. And I mean, no other kid did it. And it was pretty, but somehow she'd always make her way to the gate. Like it was unlocked. She'd find a way and kept going out. So they didn't know what to do. They were going crazy because it was really an unsafe sort of thing. So they wrote a letter to the Rebbe asking him for advice. So the Rebbe said, I suggest you check your mezuzahs. So they checked their mezuzahs, and one of the sentences in the Shema, of course, is you have to write a mezuzah. It says, "Uchtavtal ma mezuzot beitecha," you should put them on the doorposts of your house, "uvisha'arecha," and your gates. Now, it doesn't mean the gates we have today, because it's got to have a lintel, but the word is visha'arecha, and the word visha'arecha was pasul, it was written incorrectly. So that was the thing. They fixed it up and then the problem went away. So which was quite a bit. Many, many, many stories like that. Okay. But when we think of protection, right? When we think of protection, we think of physical protection. Normally, right? So it's like a security thing, right? In fact, I once saw, I don't know, probably make them in America. It's an American kind of thing to do, but like, you know, people say this house is protected by, I don't know, chub alarms or something, right? So this house is protected by a mezuzah, right? Okay, so like a sign like that. So we think of protection, and it definitely includes obviously physical protection as well. And one of the things we always want to do, it protects people from health issues, from thievery, whatever they can. But the truth is, you look deeper into the concept of mezuzah, it's not just physical protection. It's spiritual protection. And here I want to share with you two ideas that are very, very important. First idea is, what does it mean, spiritual protection? So there's a concept in Kabbalah that God created the world with different forces. So there's the forces of good, and there's the forces of impurity. In Kabbalah, known as klipah, right? Why did God do that? Because He wanted us to have free choice. Right? The whole purpose of creation. Oh, what about this? I'm out of practice here. Here we are. Right? The purpose of creation is to work, to improve, for good to prevail over evil, for morality to prevail over immorality, and to do it in a way where it's our choice, right? Where we do it, we choose good, right? That was the whole purpose of the Torah being given to the humankind and not to the angels, as the famous story of Shavuot, where the angels told God, why don't you give us the Torah? And God said to Moses, you should answer the question. And Moses says, well, you don't have a Yetzer Hara. You don't have an evil inclination. You're not tempted to do anything wrong. Why should you get the Torah? The Torah is about overcoming the evil inclinations, overcoming temptations, about making choices. Right? And that's the purpose. We've talked about this before. That's how we become better people, improve people. We change, we improve, we fail, make mistakes. We come back, we bounce back, and so on. In order for that to happen, there cannot only be the forces of good. There has to be also those forces of impurity. Now, in Kabbalah, forces of impurity are called klipah. Why are they called klipah? In Hebrew, the word klipah means a shell, a skin, like a skin of a fruit, right? What does a skin do? A skin conceals the fruit. So if you look at a banana, all you see is the skin. You're not seeing the banana. You might know there's a banana there, but you don't, right? So the forces of impurity essentially are those forces in the world that distort our values, distort our vision, make things confusing and unclear, hide the divine energy in the world, right? Now we have a principle. We have a principle in Kabbalah that goes like this. Well, it's a fundamental Jewish principle. Unlike some of the other religions, that we don't believe that anything can exist without a divine energy. Everything in this world, good or bad, is created by God. And is sustained by a divine energy that God gives it, right? So, that includes the forces of impurity. So how does it work? So Kabbalah explains that the forces of impurity, the klipot as we call them, are sustained, but sustained with a very minimal dose, so to speak, of divine energy. Because if it had a bigger dose, then it wouldn't be bad, right? It wouldn't be impure, right? And therefore, whatever these forces of impurity are, they are on a very tough existence. They exist, but just. And therefore, the forces of evil are always trying to get an extra dose of energy. Right? It's called yinikata achitzonim. It's when they... And our job is to make sure they don't get that. Our job is to make sure that they kept small. They kept minimal. Right? So Kabbalah explains like this, that a person's home is a place of holiness, right? It should be. A person's home is where they live. It's where their values live. The door to the home, we are taught, outside the door to the home, is where some of these forces lurk and are waiting to nourish some extra energy. So the mezuzah isn't just about physical protection. Mezuzah is also about spiritual protection. Making sure there's a barrier of holiness, the power of the mezuzah, the power of the Shema, that keeps them out. So that's one Kabbalistic idea of what the mezuzah does in terms of its protection. But let's go to a much deeper idea and a very important idea. And that is like this. What's the difference between a house and the street? Right? In halacha, in Jewish law, the home is called Rishut HaYachid. It's a private domain. It's a singular domain, right? A street is called a Rishut HaRabim. It's a public domain. This is very relevant, by the way, to the laws of Shabbat, for example, right? That's why in order to carry, you need an Eruv, because an Eruv, what it does is an Eruv is a symbolic wall which turns a public domain into a private domain, right? So symbolically, the house of a person is that private domain. The street is a public domain. But in the mystics explain, it goes deeper than just a public thoroughfare or a private home. Because that word, those two words, yachid and rabim, right, can be translated a bit differently. It's not just, the word yachid in Hebrew can mean private, but also can mean one, singular. The home is a symbol of oneness. Right? The street is a symbol of fragmentation. It's a symbol of multiplicity. Sure? What does that mean? So we know that when God created the world, He created a world, a fragmented world, right? One of the greatest challenges that human beings have is being fragmented. Being fragmented, right? There's a 12th or 13th century sage author called Rabbeinu Bachaya. And this is pre-technology, pre-everything, right? And he composed a prayer, a four-word prayer. And he said, Hashem yatzileini mipizur hanefesh. God, please save me from the fragmentation of the mind, of the soul. The goal of human experience is to create oneness. How to create oneness? And oneness is a very difficult thing to achieve. Why? Because life today, if Rabbeinu Bachai said this in the 12th century, I don't know what kind of prayer we have to make today, right? Today people are more fragmented than ever. We're all over the place. Our attention span has dropped to all-time lows. Why? Because we're always jumping from one thing to another. We're always checking the latest WhatsApp. We're always competing with different priorities. We're always being pulled in 17 different directions. Family requirements, business requirements, the spiritual, physical, everything, right? By definition, even just living as a Jew, for example, living as a spiritual human being creates a problem because we have physical needs. Physical and spiritual compete with each other often, right? Seem to compete with each other at least. So we have this huge problem of our life is often a reshut harabim. It's a public domain. It's a place of fragmentation. How does one achieve oneness? Oneness is achieved not by removing the fragmentation, because the fragmentation will never go away. Oneness is achieved through a life of faith and values. If we live in the world of doing, as we've talked about many times, then doing is a very fragmented world. But if we live in the world of faith and values, if we live in the world of purpose, if the underlying driving force in our life is to achieve a higher purpose, and that purpose is dictated by a set of values, by a moral code, by a moral compass that we have, and that becomes the underlying foundation of what we do, then we're able, that becomes the very foundation that educates, that inspires, that directs everything we do in life, and removes the fragmentation. Meaning, we still have the same competing priorities. We still pull in different directions. But if everything is based on the same experience, the same direction, the same purpose, same value, then everything in that then must play to the same tune. Like the famous analogy, which I've given you many times, of the symphony. A symphony is greater than it's much more beautiful than one instrument playing, than a solo instrument. Only if they follow the same conductor. If 25 instruments play out of sync, then it's terrible. It's horrible to listen to. It's painful. Because then it's just clashing. When they all play to the same music, to the same symphony, to the one conductor, it becomes beautiful. It becomes more beautiful than a solo. And that is in essence what creation is all about. God created a fragmented world by design. Because if we can take the fragmentations, the millions of instruments, and put them together, it becomes the most beautiful symphony. Now, in the mezuzah is the Shema, right? In the mezuzah is the Shema. The Shema is about the one God, correct? Hashem Echad. But the word Echad is Aleph Chet Dalet. every letter in Hebrew has a gematria, has a numerical value. So the Dalet is four, represents the four directions of the earth. The Chet is the seven heavens, and the earth, that's the idea of the eight. So we have a tradition, there's seven heavens, and then there's the earth, that's it. And then the Aleph is the oneness of God. So it's an amazing thing. Hashem Echad doesn't mean there's one God. Hashem Echad means that our mission is to create the oneness with God, to bring God into everything, into our life, to bring the values and the purpose and the meaning of creation into everything that we do, to create oneness in our life. This is something that more modern psychology is catching up to. This is the whole mindfulness movement. This is the whole concept of living with purpose and meaning, to create less stress, to create calmness, right?
I can ask a question.
Yeah.
Life is preordained and predetermined, and everything has been done before. So where is our free will?
Oh, very good question.
Only
moral choices. Moral choices. So as the Talmud tells us, everything is in the hand of heaven except for fear of heaven. So you don't get fear of heaven. Everything, it's an expression of Talmud. Hakol b'dei shamayim chutz b'yirat shamayim. In other words, you don't get to, at the end of the day, you don't get to choose how your day is going to turn out, but you do get to choose how you're going to respond to it. You don't get to choose how I'm going to talk to you, but you get to choose how you're going to respond.
The freedom of choice is an acceptance.
Well, part of it is acceptance.
Acceptance, right.
So it's the mitzvot that we do, it's the values that we have, it's the moral choices that we make, that's where we have free choice. That God doesn't control, we control it. He wants us to control it. He wants us to choose. So we get up in the morning, we make a plan for the day, because that's a moral responsibility, to live responsibly. But it might not turn out that way. If it doesn't, we make a choice how we're going to respond, right? To give you a quick example. So the idea of Hashem Echad, therefore, is one, it's not just Hashem Echad, there's one God. You know why? It's a famous thing, you know, we say Shema every day. In fact, we say it twice a day, sometimes three times a day. If Shema was just about that there's one God, once a week would be good enough too, right? We know there's one God. The one God, of course, one creator, one source of authority, one being that controls the world. Fine. But that's not why we say Shema so many times. We say Shema so many times because it's to bring ourselves the fragmentation, to take fragmentation and make it one. Bring oneness into what we do. Create values and follow a moral compass where we can bring together the pieces, and instead of them clashing with each other, instead of them being a source of tension, they can actually become a source of symphony. What's the mezuzah? The mezuzah is that connection between, that transition between the outside and the inside. The outside is Rishut HaRabim. It's a place of multiplicity, place of fragmentation. Public domain Kabbalistically symbolizes the fragmentation of the world. It's a place of many. There's no oneness. Everyone's doing something else. Right? The home is Rishut HaYachid. The mezuzah tells us, when you go into your home, how do you transition from a place of multiplicity and fragmentation to a place of oneness? You have to kiss the mezuzah on the way in. Because the mezuzah is that Hashem Echad. It's that faith in God. It's that value system. The two paragraphs of the mezuzah is the concept of living with a higher purpose. Faith in God. Study, learning, exploring knowledge, and fulfilling God's values. And that's how we create oneness. Now, just very quickly, and I see we're not going to have time for the dark part today, but we'll be more time management effective next time. But I want to end off with one very, very important thing. Because this explains a number of the laws of mezuzah. And I'll do it quickly. Mezuzah has to be written on parchment, correct? Now, one of the sources of fragmentation that we have in our lives is the tension between what we talked about many times, the tension between our godly soul and our animal soul. Right? But there doesn't have to be tension. Animal soul plays an important role. Animal soul wants us to eat and sleep and survive. It's also very selfish and self-centered and wants us to pursue pleasure. I'm saying this quickly because we've done this 100 times. But, right? But the idea of it here is that actually you can elevate the animal soul if you bring it under the banner of oneness. The mezuzah is written on parchment. Parchment is a piece of an animal. When you take a piece of an animal from and you make parshman, you write a mezuzah, you elevate the animal. You bring it together with the soul. You create a sense of oneness. It also explains why the mezuzah has to be slanted. Because the slanting of the mezuzah represents the concept of compromise. Now, one of the things people always talk about, it's a famous wedding speech that some rabbis give, is right, as people create the home, you have to know to put the mezuzah slanted, because it's not a compromise, right? But I said before, it's a strange thing, because we don't normally do that with halakha. We don't say there's two opinions and say, well, that's compromise. No, we have a system of how we rule. But the mezuzah we don't, we actually have it slanted. Why? Because the purpose of the mezuzah is that transition to the world of oneness. Oneness means you've got to bring together things. You bring together two views under one banner, under one symphony. And that's why the mezuzah is the Shema, because the whole idea is the Echad. The whole idea is that everything you have in the home becomes one. It comes the spirit of oneness. So that's the moral of the mezuzah, and that's the lesson we have. One of the greatest lessons we can learn in life is this concept of oneness. The idea to pursue oneness, to pursue values, and to always understand when we need to respond to a situation, we have a questioning life, or we have pulling priorities, we're not sure what to do, and that sort of everything seems to be clashing at one time. The first question we have to ask ourselves, what's the right thing to do? What are the values of our life dictate to do? And that's the pathway to oneness, and that's the symbol of the mezuzah, and that's why we kiss the mezuzah on the way in, to remind ourselves, it's consciousness, to be always conscious of this idea that we're going into a place of oneness, we're going to our home, where we are supposed to create a temple out of our home to be able to create the place of values, a place of spirituality, the place of oneness, and the place of calmness. So that's a little bit of the binah of mezuzah, the in-depth mezuzah. We'll take a different topic each week and try and explore it that way. Have a good day.